Hello, hello! Welcome to How to Be a Changemaker. I am so excited to have you here. If you are an organizational leader and have a deep desire to one, motivate yourself better and to lead yourself with deeper courage, confidence, and conviction, two, empower your employees to be their best, and three, innovate and create a work culture that allows everybody to thrive, you are in the right place. My name is Samantha Clark. I am your host. I'm a happiness consultant and resident change maker here, and I cannot wait to share with you all the gems and amazing goodness in this episode. Take a seat, get ready to enjoy, and tuck in. Hello, hello. Today I am joined with Marcia Goddard. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I think we've been navigating COVID, so hopefully we can come out the other side.
Yeah.
And what have you, I guess, been working on this week? Your background and your skills are quite immense. I'm going to get into those as we go through the conversation, but how is your week made up?
Well, this week has been a little bit different. I just recovered from COVID, actually, so I was ready to get back into it, and then my dog died.
Oh. So
that's a little bit sad. He was only 3 years old. So this specific week has been filled with hospital visits, but usually, obviously, my weeks are spent behind my laptop at the moment.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's a part of life, but it was my first dog, and I never thought that I could get so attached to a pet, but really, we're all a bit shocked, especially because he was only 3 years old, so very, very young.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How do we deal with loss in that sense? And you've got young children as well, haven't you?
I do, yeah. So one of them is 8. He's old enough to understand, so he obviously misses him a lot. The youngest one has just turned 3, so he keeps asking where the dog is. He doesn't understand the concept of death, so we just said he's gone and he's not coming back. And he seems to be all right with it, but he doesn't understand it yet.
Aww,
yeah.
That's not God, it's not the easiest thing, especially at the start of the year, but I hope that you can navigate your way through that.
Thank you.
And I'm guessing as well, with kind of the neuroscience background, you have all of the, I guess, the mind tricks to kind of help you process this differently or think about things differently. What inspired you to get into neuroscience?
Well, it's a bit of a weird story maybe to some. I was studying psychology at the time, and my goal had always been to become a clinical psychologist, so really to work in the field and work, you know, treat patients. Mm-hmm. And then I did a minor in medicine, mm-hmm. and I got to cut up a brain. So I got to go to the morgue and just to study the brain and learn more about how it works. We got somebody who donated the brain to science. We got to cut it up and learn more about how it works. And I was so fascinated by it, especially because there's more that we don't know than there is that we know. So we don't know more than we do know. And that just, to me, is this fascinating puzzle. And I loved learning about it. And I've been fascinated with it ever since.
Wow. And then you did your PhD in social neuroscience. What was it that attracted you to the kind of social neuroscience part?
I think, you know, it was relatively fundamental, the work that I did. So it was MRI research, but there was a real connection with actual people and actual society. I could see how the work that I did contributed to real life. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I've always valued a lot. It's also the reason that I ended up leaving academia to work in a business setting, because I really feel like I want to contribute something to society. Mm-hmm. And I think social neuroscience is a really good way to do that, because we all have a brain, don't we? We all use it every single day. Mm-hmm. So understanding it can really help us.
So tell me about that, I guess, that battle between academia. Did you not feel that you were kind of researching some fundamental things that could be embedded, or were you keen to kind of see how it works on the ground?
Well, to be honest, I was just keen to get away from that culture. I don't mean to sound rude, and obviously I have a lot of respect for academics, and I love academia as a concept. But the thing is, in practice, it was a lot of a big focus on publishing papers and submitting grant proposals, and not a whole lot of learning, not a whole lot of discovering and exploring. And that's what I wanted to do. And also wanted to do a lot of science communication, because I feel like that's your responsibility as a scientist. And that was, at least where I was working at the time, that was actively discouraged.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That didn't work for me.
And so you navigated your way into the corporate world. Where did you start working first?
I started working at an international recruitment agency. So what I wanted to do was, I said, I want to leave academia, but I want to be a neuroscientist, which is strange. It's not easy. And everybody kept telling me that's never going to happen. But I, you know, just through networking, ended up meeting an entrepreneur who had a recruitment agency. And he said, you know what, all the things that you've learned about the brain and about the relationship with social behavior, I think that's really, really relevant for the work floor. So why don't you just come work with us, study our culture, study our clients' culture, and we'll take it from there. So that's how my corporate career started.
And what were some of your, I guess, learnings from, I guess, working, like you said, on the work floor, but also bringing in a lot of the behavioral change and the science behind it? Could you see that there were patterns that needed disrupting?
Absolutely. I think the main thing that I saw was that, you probably know this very well too, the way we work in the 21st century is so fundamentally different from the 20th century. So the 21st century work floor is dominated by change. There's change everywhere all the time. And I think there's a lot we can learn from neuroscience about how to deal with that change effectively from a behavioral perspective. So that's what I've been focusing on.
So what are some of the key tenets to how we navigate change? Because that's a big thing. You know, you're right. A lot of my clients are, how do we prepare our managers to, you know, navigate this roller coaster of change? How do they support their teams to think about change differently? Like, what are some of the the core things that we should be practicing or doing?
Well, I think the one thing that is important to understand is that whenever there is a change, there's going to be a stress response, because our brains just react to change by triggering a stress response, because a change means that there's unpredictability and our brains do not like unpredictability very well. So I think the secret is in being able to frame that stress response as challenging instead of threatening. There are different ways of framing stress and response that comes with it. And if you're able to frame it as a challenge, then you get completely different behaviors, which is where you want to be. And the way to get there, the way to get to that challenge interpretation, is in culture, it's in leadership, and obviously also in individual factors. So having all of that in order allows you to create a team, create a culture where people frame those changes as exciting instead of scary.
How do we get to a point where we can see those changes as exciting versus just, you know, high cortisol inducing? And especially if, you know, you and I both work in culture development, but things can be slow to change. Like, what can we do at a grassroots level as a manager, if you know that the culture you're in is quite toxic or slow moving or just doesn't get it?
Yeah, I think the honest truth is that, you know, if you're in management and you see the culture around you isn't conducive to that, then your circle of influence is going to be limited, but you do have an influence on your own team. So I would say try to create that environment within your own team, and then hopefully it will spread out to other teams as well. And that's really about giving people autonomy, giving people trust, allowing people to fail and to experiment and to learn from their mistakes. So it's doing all those good things within your own team so that at least you become resilient as a team, as a whole. And then hopefully the rest of the organization will see the benefits of it. But it is difficult. I always say that as much as we would like it to be different, culture really starts from the top. So if you want to make a massive, if you really want to make a big change, then you kind of need the leadership to be involved in it as well. They don't have to know everything. They don't have to be perfect, but they have to be willing to reflect, I think.
And so how do you use neuroscience when you think about topics like diversity and inclusion? Like, where is our brain maybe fundamentally blocking us from progressing there?
Bias. If you have a brain, you have bias. And you know, the topic itself is, there's so much emotion there. If even if you just say diversity and inclusion, people will lock up immediately, afraid of saying the wrong thing, which is also a form of bias. So I think what I try to do in the work that I do around diversity and inclusion is to open up a conversation where everybody has a voice, both the marginalized group, but also the privileged groups, because if we want to get people together, we need to listen to everybody and to help people understand that being biased, favoring people that look like you or that you have something in common with, is not, that in itself is not racism. That is normal. That is bias, but that is the way our brains have evolved over time. It has kept us safe. It has kept us safe to understand who's part of our group and who isn't. So reflecting on your own bias and then taking steps to mitigate that bias, I think that really is the best way forward, and to leave your judgment at the door. Because as soon as the brain, people with a brain, feel judged, they will lock up and then you don't have a conversation anymore.
How do you reflect on your own bias if you're unaware of it, though?
That's why you need, it needs to be a group effort. You need to do it together. There's, I mean, it's even for me as a consultant, you might recognize that as well. I'm biased too. So I have to work, even though I know exactly how it works, I have to work really, really hard. And I just use my social environment if I'm by myself, if I'm working on a team, that I can, you know, speak to the people on my team. But it's almost impossible to challenge your own bias. So you need other people to do it. And in order to do so, you need to have a friendly environment, a psychologically safe environment. So don't try to do it by yourself. Get other people involved. Have these difficult and uncomfortable conversations.
And how might a manager think about creating psychological safety, especially if they themselves maybe might be, I guess, fearful of certain topics or conversations themselves? Like, how do we begin to move into that space?
Yeah, that's one of the leadership skills that's so incredibly important, isn't it? I think vulnerability is a really valuable skill to have in this sense, because if you as a manager are able to be vulnerable to your team, show them that you are human as well, that in itself will already create some form of psychological safety. There's more involved. I mean, there's all, what's also involved is, again, allowing people to make mistakes without judging them and allowing them to speak up about what's going on without judgment. But being vulnerable as a manager is so incredibly powerful.
Are you also, I guess, implementing changes within the HR structures in companies? Like, do you get involved? I remember reading an article where you were talking about the need for more gamification in the recruitment process. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So I do a lot of work on certain, I try to combine process with behavior. So if you try to stimulate the behavior and then you have processes like performance management, for example, that you can use to facilitate the behaviors. But the reason that I am a big fan of gamification is because change, as we talked about before, is always a little bit scary. People don't really like to change. If you do it in a gamified way, it becomes less scary because you step into a game world. You step into a different world. So it feels like you're a little bit separated from the real harsh reality and you're in a game reality where making mistakes is not an issue. If you play a game, just think of, did you play Super Mario when you were younger, maybe?
Yeah.
So how many times did you die before you finished the game?
Too many to count.
Exactly, hundreds of times. But that wasn't an issue. It was not like, oh no, I messed up. I guess I'm a failure. No, it was like, okay, I messed up. Let's try this again. That's the thing about gamification. It triggers us. If you use the right game mechanics, it triggers you to keep trying. And when it comes to changing your behavior, just hanging in there, pushing through, that's one of the most important things. So that's one of the reasons that I really like using gamification in the right way. And by the right way, I mean, don't make everything a competition. That happens a lot. Like, oh, let's make it into a game. Let's compete against each other. But there are many different types of game mechanics, and you have to figure out which ones are the right ones to use.
And so you're thinking about game mechanics within a team situation or just at the recruitment phase?
Oh, any situation. You can just, whatever situation. So if you look at the recruitment process, you can use gamification to bring out the skills in the candidates. But an alternative would be, which is something that, you know, we've worked on in the past as well, is to just gamify the entire process. So don't just do a gamified assessment. Turn the interview process into a game for the recruiters themselves as well. Any interaction that you have on the work floor is in itself a game. We behave in a way according to certain rules. Those are the rules of the game. You can change them to make it more fun or to make it more effective. That is the essence of gamification. You can do that anywhere.
Mm. I want to lean a little bit into the work that you do, or the insights that you're gleaning from Formula One. What kind of led you to sit and study the behavior and culture of Formula One, and what has that got to teach us?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. So I've been watching Formula One since I was a child. I used to be a big fan of Michael Schumacher, the second most successful driver in the history of the sport. Mm-hmm. And as I was working in my first job when I left academia, so at that recruitment agency, I started to see from the research that I did that, you know, as I said, the workflow was dominated by change and high pressure. People felt pressured all the time. So then the scientist in me started to think about, you know, what could we do? What could I do in order to find out what behaviors are conducive to dealing with that change and dealing with that high pressure on the work floor? And that's when it sort of hit me. I was sitting in my boss's office at the time, and I all of a sudden said, I should study F1, because Formula One in itself, by definition, is dominated by change. It's governed by the FIA, which decides every year what the rules of the game are going to be. So Formula One teams have to reinvent themselves every single season. So it's the perfect laboratory environment to study these things. So that's how it started. But I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a network at all. So it was just it started out as a joke. But then I'm really stubborn. So so I just thought, it kept coming up in my mind. And I was doing some keynotes in the UK at the time. So I just brought it up every single time I was in the UK, because I live in the Netherlands. But every time I was there, I would say on stage, look, the perfect environment to study this, because I would be talking about change and workflow and things like that, I would mention Formula One. And then at some point, there was somebody in the room who knew somebody, and that person knew somebody. And before you know it, I was at a Formula One factory speaking to the people there.
Oh, wow. So what are some of the things that you've been gleaning from this journey?
So the main things that I've learned is how to build a healthy, high-performing culture. So high-performing sounds harsh. People always get they have a bad connotation with the word high-performing. But a high-performing team is just a healthy team. That's what I mean by it. And what I learned from speaking to these people on these teams is that there are certain elements to your culture that allow you to really deal with, you know, those changes and that pressure in a way that is conducive to performance. So that is, for example, constant communication. We talk about feedback cultures all the time. Well, they have that. They evaluate everything, and they have systems for it, that the behavior is there. So it's constant communication. It's the most important one to me is the no blame philosophy. Mm. The no blame philosophy means Mercedes markets this really, really well. They say when something happens, you blame the problem, not the person. I love that phrase because it means that you look at what happened and what can we do next time to prevent it from happening again, instead of pointing fingers. Mm-hmm. So that was a big lesson. Another one was the one team mindset. So if you have a mission as a company, if you have one thing that everybody can get behind, everybody can rally behind and work for, then everyone is going to be more intrinsically motivated, which obviously really helps you to perform to the best of your abilities. And then the last one is the combination of short and long-term perspectives. So if you have a mission, you know, for example, I used to be the head of people and culture at Tony's Chocolate Only, which is a chocolate company. Mm. And their mission is to eradicate slavery from the cocoa trade. It's a great mission, but it takes decades to get there. So just having that mission isn't enough. You need to have short-term goals as well. And that is something that I've learned from my research as well, that in order to get to the long-term goal, you need to have the short-term goals to keep people going, to keep them motivated, to give them a feeling of success every once in a while. So those are all behavioral lessons that I've learned from speaking to people on these teams.
And so when you think about the short and long-term goals, when we think about things like the Great Resignation and employees really questioning, you know, if this is the right job or the role that they should be in, how can a company reassert what they stand for? Because, you know, sometimes I speak to clients and they can't really pinpoint the overarching goal of the company or, you know, the mission that feels relatable to them, and also that they can feel like they're making a dent in it as well. Like, how does a company go about refreshing that? Or again, at a managerial level, what can they do to kind of keep them aligned with the mission and vision?
I think the difficult thing about it is that there are, I mean, if you have a company and it's been around for 50 years, then most likely your mission isn't going to be that clear. Mm. So as I mentioned, Tony's, it's a B Corp as well. So it's one of those 21st century companies, really with a mission to make the world a better place. And people feel like, oh, we need to have a mission like that. Mm-hmm. You don't. You really don't. The mission can also be to be the most successful, I don't know, accounting firm in the world. That can also be the mission. As long as you define the mission and then you work towards that mission. What I see happening a lot, and I don't know, I'm curious to hear how you feel about this with all the companies that you work with. But what I see a lot is that companies are now looking for some socially accepted mission. It has to be, oh, we're going to save the planet. We're going to make the world a better place. Obviously, that's good. It's good that they're looking for that. But if you only say that that is your mission, but that's not really what you do, that's not going to fly. That's not going to work. That's not going to attract the right people either. People are going to be left disappointed. So I think it might be better to be honest about the mission and then to say, we just want to be the best in our industry, because that is going to attract people who want to contribute to that mission. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the advice that I always give organizations when I get this question, is figure out what your mission is first and be congruent. It has to be congruent with what you're actually doing.
I think that's wholeheartedly the thing, is that congruence. And I think there's often a lack of that, or pretending that this is the mission. You said, because it's socially acceptable and this is what the current wave is. And I do feel that that was also the practice when it comes to D&I, or when it comes to, you know, really thinking about well-being practices. It's not just putting a stamp on, this is the thing that we're aligning ourselves with now because it's cool. And they will get found out as well.
That's the thing. And that's why people leave. Like, it's one of the main reasons. Like, the culture or the way of working is not consistent with what they're saying they are. And that is going to lead to problems. And, you know, it's better to be honest about it. Then at least you'll get people who are willing to work for the mission that you actually have. There's nothing wrong with that.
What's your mission?
I've thought about that a lot. And I think my mission is to have a positive impact on the world with the work that I do. And that's incredibly broad. And that's because I've had this really weird career. I went from academia to consulting to I work in education. I do lots of different things. But what they all have in common is that I've always tried to help and to have a positive impact on either people's physical health, mental health, or people's education, things like that. So having a positive impact on the world, that's really what I want to do.
And what's had the most positive impact on your mental health?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's my kids. Oh, that's a really standard answer, though. But I think, you know, I changed when I had children, and my drive to do something good increased exponentially when I had them. But to be honest, I started working officially this January for the Contentment Foundation, which is a nonprofit that aims to bring well-being to 1 billion people within one generation. And working with these people who are the brightest minds when it comes to psychology, neuroscience, behavioral change, education, also has taught me a lot about how to take care of yourself. So just working with them has been a massive positive impact for me throughout, especially throughout this COVID era, which is not good for anybody's mental health.
No. What are some of the practices that you've started?
Mindfulness is a big one. I mean, I'm a trained psychologist, so obviously I knew mindfulness, and I'm a coach as well. So I use mindfulness, but to be honest, never really, really did it myself. Couldn't bring myself to do it. And now I make it a habit to actually really put it in practice. It's about self-care, just taking better care of myself, because I would be so busy trying to make everybody's lives better that I would forget about my own. So I would work until midnight. I wouldn't eat right. I wouldn't exercise enough. So what I do now is I have blocks on my calendar I'm on a dance team, and I used to cancel a lot because I'd be busy. I don't do that anymore. I've learned that I need to just go, because it will make me more efficient, more productive, and it will make me better as well if I do it.
I love that. So it's, you know, it's making that promise to yourself and adhering to it as well. And I think that often goes awry when you are making change and supporting others to be great. You know, we can make ourselves invisible in the process.
Absolutely. And one other thing that I learned, which is, it's a really interesting story. I was meeting the people who were working for the foundation. And I had a meeting with one of them, and I asked her, how are you doing? And we always say fine, don't we? We always say, yeah, fine. and then you move on. And she said, I don't know. And then we had a whole conversation about why she didn't know if she was all right. That was such a refreshing answer. So it's also taught me to be, which is also something that I preached but didn't really practice. It's okay to not be okay. And it's okay to say that out loud as well.
Yeah, I think sometimes we're either fearful of saying it out loud because we don't want to burden the other person, or we don't really know if they can handle whatever it is that we might want to share. And so we end up just like buttoning up and closing in on ourselves, which doesn't really help. When you think about obstacles on your journey, kind of either navigating academia, moving into corporate, how did you overcome them?
Well, I had to overcome my own insecurities when I was younger, because I always thought that I was not smart.
Okay.
So in high school, I did well up until I was about 15, 16 years old. And then stuff became difficult. And I'd never learned how to learn because everything had always been easy. So things started to become difficult. And that's when I thought, oh, apparently I'm not so smart. And I convinced myself of this fact. So one huge obstacle for me was it took me a while to figure out that I wanted to study psychology, and I was scared to start because I was like, I don't know if I'm smart enough to go to university. So I started working for a psychologist because I figured if I can see what she does in practice, maybe we can talk about what it's like to study psychology. And when I had the courage to say to her that I was considering going to university to get a bachelor's and a master's in psychology, she said, oh, you're definitely not college material.
Oh, wow. Thanks.
So that was definitely, that's one very big hurdle that it took me another year and a half to be like, wait a minute, I think she's wrong, and then do it anyway. So that was one obstacle that I've had to overcome, just my own insecurities around, you know, intelligence. And I know that I've had to deal with racism. I'm a woman of color, so racism, sexism, it's all been there. Mm-hmm. But I think the main obstacle for me over time has been that I never acknowledged it. I didn't start acknowledging it and really realizing it until the Black Lives Matter movement gained traction internationally. So that's a recent process that I've gone through that I think has really helped me to be more effective in the work that I do.
Tell me a bit more about that. Do you think that it was maybe you just shut it down or ignored it because it was easier to kind of progress with the work that you want to do? Or tell me a little bit more about.
I think it was partially what you're saying, that it was just easier to ignore it, but I think also partially that I just blissfully naive, I guess. I don't think that way. So I couldn't imagine that other people thought that way, which is strange because when I look back at it, I've had some weird experiences in academia and in my life over time that are definitely questionable. Mm-hmm. But I think I just pushed it away, and I was really focused as well. I had this goal. The goal first was to get my bachelor's degree, then my master's, then my PhD. I was just only going towards that goal, and anything that was in my way that didn't align with those goals, I ignored. So maybe I just ignored it out of fear, perhaps. I'm not really there yet to really understand why that happened. I am glad that I do realize what happened now, because it has changed my perspective on many things.
And I guess that really rings true, you know, the whole growth mindset and just focusing on what you want your end ambition to be and just forgetting other things in your pathway. And I guess when we get very tunnel vision about certain things, nothing can stop us.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm really, 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 really stubborn.
How has the stubborn been a bit of a curse? I mean, it sounds like a gift in one place, but how has it played against you being stubborn?
Well, I'm in the business of changing people's minds, changing people's behaviors, and being really stubborn about what the right course of action is sometimes works against me. So I can give you a concrete example. As I said, I was the head of people and culture at this chocolate company. And there was some stuff that had to change there. Everybody saw it. There were steps that had to be taken. But I wasn't very good at that because when you work in a corporate setting, there's office politics. That's just a fact of life. And that's absolutely okay. But my stubbornness gets in the way of that. It gets in the way of being pragmatic. It gets in the way of being smart about how to reach your goals. So sometimes I haven't reached goals, or it took me longer to reach a goal because I was so stubborn. That's the honest truth.
And how do you recognize that stubbornness in other people and support them through it? Because it might be, you know, sometimes I speak to some managers and they can't see the root of the problem.
Yeah.
And are reticent that actually the course of action they've been taking is working. And I'm like, it hasn't though. And so there is this kind of continuous conversation for them to realize their own stubbornness around the subject.
Yeah, absolutely. So I try to use a combination of reflection. So just having these deep conversations with them where you ask a lot of why, how, what questions, and combine it with, let's have a look at the data. There's so much data, especially when it comes to business decisions. There's a lot of data available these days about how you're doing. So I try to just work with them, work through the data to see if what they're doing actually makes sense from an objective perspective, or is it just because it feels good? Like, and usually there are some discrepancies there. So that will help. But, you know, it's also getting people to reflect also, is also about creating an environment where they're willing to do that. So I focus mostly on creating an environment where they're comfortable speaking to me, a psychologically safe environment for them as well. Because even the top leaders at really large organizations, they're human. So they need that safety too. They also need to feel heard. They also need to feel like they can fail without being judged. So building relationships is a really important part of the work.
Oh my gosh, I could speak to you for ages. I just wondered one more thing. What do you think has shifted in your life and your business maybe during this pandemic, for better or worse?
So for better, I'm more international than ever. Because it used to be, I live in Europe, and it used to be that if I wanted to work with organizations in the US, I'd have to get on a plane and go there. Now everybody is sort of used to, you know, doing the work virtually. So that has definitely helped. But building relationships is much more difficult through a computer. So that is one of the things that has become more difficult. And it's I think this is a human, this is just a global thing as well. It's more difficult to take care of yourself when you're in your home office by yourself with nobody around you to say, hey, let's go for a walk, or hey, it's lunchtime. So it's those basic things as well. You need to be more disciplined about that too.
Have you chosen a word for this year or a sentiment for this year?
Hope. Because it dies last, doesn't it? Hope dies last. It's if something doesn't change this year when it comes to COVID and everything that we've been going through, then I think we're in trouble, to be honest. I live in the Netherlands, where the learning curve seems to be somewhat horizontal when it comes to dealing with, you know, new variants and things like that. So I have hope that this year is going to be better.
Yeah, I was watching some of the protests, the anti-vax protests.
Which is weird. They're turning into political protests now, with all sorts of other things getting being put into the mix that have nothing to do with vaccine or mask mandates or anything like that. It's really strange. So I have hope that this year we're going to fix that and be better.
Well, fingers crossed. Thank you so much for your time. Is there any questions you would like to ask, or anything that you want to share on how people can find out a bit more about your work?
Well, if they want to find out more about specifically the Contentment Foundation, which is the foundation that I work for, they can go to contentment.org/business, because that's where, you know, we talk about the work that we do. So that's definitely something that I wanted to share. And I actually want to ask you the question that you asked me as well. What is your word for 2022?
So my word is consistency. And I think it is just keeping up with the practices that have sustained me throughout this crazy period, but also picking up new practices and being consistent with those. So, just layering up a few different exercise regimes. And I've moved now, so I'm being consistent with either going for a walk in the park or going to look at the sea in the morning. So it's either one of those, but I need to do that every day.
Oh, you live by the sea? That's really nice. That's amazing.
Unfortunately, with COVID, it's been a bit like I'm on my balcony this week, but that's it. But yeah, consistency for me this year.
Love that. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, no worries. Well, thank you so much.
Hello, hello. Well, what another fantastic episode. Thank you so much for carving out the time to hang out with us and hear everything that was shared today on our podcast. If you are interested in becoming a change maker and something has piqued your interest and you want to either revamp your own ways of looking at your well-being as you lead a team through change, or maybe you want to create deeper interventions in your company that are going to stick and that people care about actually using, why not join our Changemaker certification? This is our roadmap to helping you go through our three areas of change: becoming a better change maker, empowering and inspiring others to do the same, and amplifying the message that you have created. Check out all the details of our Changemaker certification on loveitleaveit.co, and I cannot wait to get started with you. See you soon for another amazing episode. Bye for now.